You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. This is Friday, July 1st, 2022. You're on episode 28. JJ Sefton here along with CBD and returning once again, the irrepressible and estimable Joe Mannix. Gentlemen, good Independence Day weekend morning.
Good afternoon, morning something. I don't know. Where is everybody? Yeah, it's morning for everyone here.
Go with good day. Why not?
Yes, good day. Good day, everyone. And today we're gonna lead off. There's a lot of things happening, obviously, with really the big news coming out of the Titanic decisions from the Supreme Court. But we want to lead off with a comment that Joe had a couple of days ago on one of the threads, where he basically makes the assertion that the GOP is dead, and even if we do manage to somehow take the GOP back from the establishment that now controls it, essentially the government is so far gone and so corrupt that even having a party that we do control, it's not going to make that much of a difference, if any difference at all. Joe, why don't you weigh in on that one?
Sure. Thank you. And had I known you were going to quote that in the morning report, I probably would have been more complete with the statement. But and thank you for that, by the way. But yeah, basically, it's my take on it is that I think when I say the GOP is hopelessly corrupt and the government is hopelessly corrupt, I do think those things are true. I think that's true specifically in national terms. So depending on where you live, your state level GOP might be able to be subverted and taken over and put back on the rails, and your state government might be in that same category. Or maybe you live in one of those few states that actually has a decent government already, in which case don't move. But I think that at the national level, the national party is beyond salvation. It is so deeply in this uniparty complex, as it's often called. I think that's as good a name as any. And they are not conservatives. They are not part of the body politic. They're this offshoot, this rump hypothetical opposition within the party system. And they're not a real party. They're not a real party, and they don't do any real work. And the government itself, party notwithstanding, I think the government itself at the federal level is so captured and so corrupt that it can't be fixed. And we see this all the time in the commentary. So take the you mentioned the Supreme Court during the preamble, this tremendous, not as tremendous as I hoped it would be, but this pretty good ruling on the EPA. It didn't get rid of Chevron, but it did slap down the EPA and say, no, you're not allowed to go this far off the rails and this far outside your mandate. And the general attitude among a lot of people, left and right, is, so what? We can just do it anyway. We can go back to incrementalism. And I think that those people who are taking that approach, which is, okay, fine, we can't go force all the coal-fired power plants to shut down right now, but we can keep throwing obstacles and burdens in the way, I think those people are right, and that is essentially what's going to happen. And it's the government at the federal level doesn't know how to do anything else and refuses to do anything else and won't be convinced to do anything else, which is why in terms of long-term future, I don't see it as sustainable. The government cannot be this corrupt and be maintained. So something has to happen, either final total takeover, some sort of gradual dissolution, a nullification crisis, which honestly I think might be the best outcome. But the great work in the court, and I'm not going to disparage that, this has been a very, very good week. And it's a great way to lead into Independence Day on Monday. But I don't see that the federal government is salvageable, our recent wins notwithstanding.
I have to agree with you, unfortunately. What disturbs me most of all is the comfort and ease with which our representatives cross the aisle and accommodate what we would think of as completely unacceptable political decisions on the part of their opponents, because they don't see them as opponents. They see their partners across the aisle as simply fellow grafters, perhaps. And I think that indicates that there is no coherent political philosophy in Washington other than self-aggrandizement, self-enrichment, and yeah, well, that's pretty much it. And without that political philosophy, without that coherent and rational attitude toward how to govern, we are lost.
I was like, you mentioned, you know, when you were speaking, you mentioned something about the EPA's mandate to do whatever its alleged purpose is, which is allegedly environmental protection. But I'd say that the mandate, it's not even a legitimate mandate. I mean, I wrote this with the decision is that in Roberts, John Roberts, who we, you know, rightly deride as just being a horrendous jurist, he kind of hit the nail on the head in what he said with his opinion, in that it is really up to Congress to enact laws. It is not up to the bureaucracy to enact any sort of regulations or laws. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him. He was much more exacting in his verbiage. But the fact remains, and this has been the crisis of our nation going back, probably beginning with the 16th Amendment, which was the direct election of senators, but certainly with the coming of the New Deal and the ramping up of the bureaucratic state. There is no precedent. There is nothing in the Constitution. The Ninth and the Tenth Amendments and the founding of this nation are predicated upon the principles of all power should reside with the citizenry and then from there with the states. And any sort of powers that we deem that the federal government should have are very limited and very specific. And now we are in topsy-turvy world where the bureaucracy passes edicts and regulations that have the power of law, and there's nothing you can do to stop it short of taking them to court to stop it. And then 9 times out of 10, the court is a rubber stamp for the leftists anyway, and they're just going to deem it kosher and everything is fine, like they've done with Obamacare, like they did with Roe versus Wade, and so on and down the road. So I agree, this premise that everything going beyond the GOP and the uniparty, I just feel that. And this is what Donald Trump and the brilliance of Donald Trump really made so many people see, and this is his greatest achievement, was he exposed the absolute myth that we live in a two-party system where there are checks and balances, and one party really is the party of the people, and the other one is the party of big government. No, to a greater or lesser extent, the GOP is part of FDR's New Deal. They just feel that they can manage big government, you know, a little bit cheaper and a little bit more efficiently than the left. But the goal is still the same. It's just the taking of power from the people and from the individual and vesting it in a bureaucratic, top-down, centralized government. And this is the problem we are facing. So, you know, where do we go from here?
And it ties into also something CBD mentioned as well, which is there is another sort of broader, longer term arc that I think might be coming to an end. And if this is the case, then it might change some of my assumptions. I sort of don't think so, because the deep state is so unaccountable. And Trump tried to take some actions there. And now Supreme Court Justice Jackson did away with it through an executive order to reclassify a bunch of federal workers. So, I mean, at least he tried. But in that, since the fall of the Soviet Union, so that's what, 31 years ago now, approximately, we've been in this period of political convergence in Washington, where the two sides, quote unquote, started agreeing with each other a lot more than they disagreed with each other. And on really big primal things in the lead up to that, you know, through the 90s, we had both sides agreeing on immigration. We had both sides agreeing on trade. We had both sides agreeing more or less on taxation. These are pretty big things that everybody was agreeing on. And then they just kept building the quorum. And this idea that bipartisanship is the pinnacle of statesmanship. And that is not right. And this is, I think, what CBD, you mentioned a little bit earlier, that we're always willing to cross the aisle and we're always willing to reach out and cooperate. No, not if you're an opposition party, you're not. If you're an opposition party, you agree with the opposition on certain things for the purpose of getting the business of government done. But you don't agree with that other side on things that actually matter to you. And this means that they don't actually disagree with each other. And we're sort of at the culmination of this 30-year trend of convergence in Washington between the quote-unquote two sides. And Donald Trump knocked a couple of pillars out from under that when he was elected. Was, no, I'm not on your side. I am on this other side, and we're going for it now. Screw you. And that is now, in terms of the population, I think, growing. It's not we're all fighting for essentially the same thing so we can go along to get along. It's no, we are in firm opposition now. And I'm wondering if that political structure is starting to deconverge and it's starting to separate again. And if it is, then from a politician standpoint, that's interesting. I don't think it makes a lick of difference to the deep state. But in terms of these fractured parties at the state level and making potentially very significant state level actions, like we see in West Virginia around terminating ESG-related finance companies' ability to manage state assets. West Virginia is also the cause of this EPA ruling that we just got this week. And then, of course, we have the big guns down in Florida. But I think that this is the beginning of sort of that fracturing of our political convergence after the fall of the USSR. And that is, I don't think that helps with the bureaucracy at all, because they're utterly unaccountable. But in terms of the state governments and the attitude and the culture in the country, I think we might be in the beginning stages of a move that's as important as the political activity after the fall of the Soviet Union.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago, or moments ago, I should say, what the business of government. Well, that's the question. What is the business of government? What is the purpose of government? Who gets to decide, what it is? The American Revolution, as I mentioned, was, the government is a very, very limited thing. It's a necessary evil that has to be there basically to secure our borders, ha, 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 and dictate foreign policy, deliver the mails, and essentially in other matters, it's basically limited, really should be limited to that and nothing more. But we've obviously gone off the rails. So the movement now is to determine what is government's purpose? Who gets to decide what government's purpose is? Do we go back to the notion of individual liberty and limited powers to our state governments, and very, very, very limited powers to a federal government, whatever that might be? Or are we going to devolve into a top-down sort of socialist dictatorship, if you will? We seem to be going in that direction, but there is a lot of pushback at the local and individual level against this. There is a grassroots movement, I think, against it, whether a lot of people recognize it from a philosophical standpoint. And certainly, with these rulings of the court, to a greater or lesser extent, it is at the very least, it's a warning shot in a way across the bow, whether that's they're going to heed that warning or not, who knows. Or it does provide some relief, at least in the short term, against these encroachments on our freedom, which, let's face it, when you try to decarbonize the United States economy, you're basically going to kill everybody, because we are carbon. Everything we use is carbon. And to do that is to send us back to the dark ages.
Maybe the issue is that local control is going to be the savior of America. I mean, you can get arguments from people that the destruction of America began in 1861 with Lincoln and his attempt to retain some semblance of a union. But even discarding that idea, you go to Wilson, whose progressive politics were awful and destructive. Then moved to FDR, where everything was, as you say, top down. The creation of the Social Security system was a catastrophic mistake that set the tone for a $30 trillion deficit. But all of this is in service to a powerful federal government. And until we destroy that power, until power returns to the municipalities and, to the towns, the cities, and even to the states, I think Joe is correct that we are going to have some chaotic breakup, as he said, five or six, regions that are very wary of the behavior of the other ones. And I unfortunately don't see any way out of it short of an equally catastrophic event that I'm not going to discuss.
I have to ask the question though. I'm sorry, Joe. Just the CBD is that if we do break up into what essentially will be Yugoslavia post 1992, into these five states where everybody hates each other's guts or whatever to one degree or another, what makes you think that this bureaucracy, which is basically trying to subvert and subsume and really conquer everybody in this country, what makes you think that they're going to allow that to happen? If they don't, then we're really into some interesting times.
Yes, and in fact, that's the catastrophe that I'm talking about.
Okay.
The protection of the bureaucracy is its highest purpose, and breaking up the United States into in the United States of Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma is antithetical to everything they believe. Will Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma have to fight? And I think the answer is yes, they will have to fight. And that fight will be incredibly nasty And unfortunately, Americans are very good at that kind of fighting. And it's a depressing thought. And thank you so much, Joe, for this cheery idea on, you know, on the beginning of this weekend.
Sorry about that. But I also think to what you were saying, JJ, it's, would they, you know, sit still for it? Well, no, certainly not. But the point, I guess, is that they might not have a choice, right? These structural problems in the federal government, the corruption, the inefficiency, the bankruptcy, the tyranny, it might actually start falling apart under its own weight once somebody pushes it. And I think that push comes from the states. But if they suddenly, say, run out of money, which I think is a significant possibility, then they simply cannot sustain what they've been doing indefinitely into the future. And though nobody is happy about it, and all of the institutions still have their same names and their same grand seals, and they generate all the paperwork, they aren't actually able to go do anything. They can't afford it. And when they get kicked out, they get kicked out. And that's sort of a soft nullification,
breakup kind of thing. But that's certainly a more appealing way of this happening. And I think you can see it happening in Florida as we speak. DeSantis is busily creating a state bureaucracy that is simply more efficient and better than the federal bureaucracy that he is carefully not mirroring. And Texas is doing the same thing. You know, this really wasn't in the news because it's not very pleasant news for the progressives. But Texas is pushing back very, very hard against bankers who insist on ESG and, you know, are trying to deplatform, you know, oil companies and gun manufacturers and so on. Texas said, no, you can't do that. Otherwise, we're not going to do business with you. I know that two of the biggest banks in the United States have gotten a huge amount of flack from those states. And that might be a harbinger of things to come. That will happen more and more and more. And Joe's supposition that it's going to be a, you know, a gradual degradation of the federal government into sort of a, you know, useless shell. Maybe that is the best way for it to happen.
Just to define terms just for one second for people who aren't aware, ESG, I believe, refers to environmental, social, and I forgot what the G is.
Governmental.
Government. Essentially, what banks and financial institutions like BlackRock and Larry Fink, burn in hell, what they're trying to do is basically shut off either companies or even states that from finances and from banking that refuse to go along with what they feel are proper views on everything, as CBD mentioned, from guns to abortion to transsexualism to you name it. And if you don't play their game, or if you don't use their pronouns, they're gonna cut you off from the money. But then this raises another point. We're talking about dissolution of government, and we get into the whole global reset category here. So if the official or traditional government of the United States falls apart, what's to prevent someone like a Klaus Schwab or a Hans-Jörg Wyss or a George Soros or a Larry Fink or whomever from basically picking up the mantle? What basically, they're the ones that are kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes in Davos and wherever as a de facto government of itself. Think in terms of Rollerball from 1975. We have the giant corporation. There's no more governments, but you have these banks that are now pulling the strings. So, you know, with technology the way it is, and with the move to get into a cashless society, even if we do gain another rebirth of independence, so to speak, from this totalitarian regime in D.C., we still have a totalitarian regime in Brussels and in the halls in Zurich and wherever that's going to basically pull our strings because they control the purse strings. So ticklish situation that.
Except that in the next century, Europe is going to be Islamic.
That
has been suggested by several very, very intelligent people who probably know more about it than most. So is Brussels even going to survive an Islamic dictatorship in, you know, 7 of the 11 countries of Europe, however many there are? I have no idea now. You know, I don't know that the European Union is going to survive 40 or 50% of its citizens being Muslim, and they will have far more significant problems in their own backyards, and they will not be able to meddle in the affairs of the United States. however the United States shakes out in the next 50 or 100 years.
You know, as long as we're on cheerful news, which Joe gave us, and speaking of Islam, we have the Biden junta importing Muslims like crazy with the open borders now, more even than as much or, you know, or a significant portion coming through to such an extent that they're setting up, all kinds of social services for Islamic immigrants coming through, illegal immigrants, I should say, coming through the southern border. So we have that to look forward to. We have America turning into basically either Dearborn or Minneapolis. So unless we fight that, we too face that problem of becoming part of the global caliphate, if not at the same time as Europe, then certainly not long afterwards if we don't do something about that.
Yeah, it's a problem here, and it's, of course, ties into the close the damn border, but we all know the likelihood of that happening. But what CBD brought up there about Europe's demography is, I think, very, very likely to happen. There's another demographic question elsewhere in the world, and that is, over the next 100 years, we're looking at an effective depopulation of a large chunk of East Asia. Japan, Korea, and Red China are all in full-on demographic collapse. Red China, worst of all, although it hasn't shown up in all the numbers yet, but they're aging incredibly quickly. They destroyed their own population with one child and then a handful of other policies. And it doesn't matter that they've all been reversed. The damage is done. So between a demographic collapse in Asia and a demographic transition in Europe, what I think we're really looking at, and the whatever happens in the United States, I think is going to simply, in some respects, just be a part of the wider overall theme. The post-war order is now cracked up. It hasn't failed yet. It hasn't collapsed yet. But the world in which we all live and in which we all grew up, which is the world as it was, that bipolar post-war world, started getting its first major cracks with the fall of the Soviet Union, and it's just been accelerating since then. And some of that's our own doing, and some of it is victims of fate and the fact that nothing holds still. But the end of Europe as we know it and the end of Asia as we know it in the next century, these are serious problems. And when you add into those serious problems the fact that all of the structure that has been built and the governing standards that have been developed since the last global catastrophe are now all falling to pieces at the same time, there are a lot of things all happening at the same time, and is another reason why I think that any planning that anybody is doing sort of at the institutional level that depends on a continuation of the status quo is going to fail.
You know, on that cheerful note, let's take a bit of a break. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. Go take yourself a Valium and hold tight. We'll be right back.
Or Hemlock.
Oy
vey.
We're back. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. We're having a really good chuckle over something that our boss, Ace, over at Ace of Spades headquarters, decided to use as a name for this woman. What's her name? Cassidy Hutchinson or something like that? This bald-faced liar who claims that Donald Trump lunged across the seat in the beast to grab the steering wheel on January 6th. And Ace named her, and this is in CBD, or Joe, whichever, I forgot who, you can tell the story of how he came about with the name. He calls her Madison Cornbread. It's just like the funniest thing. But the story is great. God, we call that. It's one of you guys tell the story.
Yeah, Ace chimed in on the comments. I don't remember. It might have been yesterday, the last day of June. I don't remember fully, but he chimed in and said, look, it's not actually derived from anything about her or what she said. It's some character that he had made up of a generic millennial woman working at a Cinnabon, and he ended up liking it so much he didn't want to give it to a bit player. And so assigned it to Cassidy Hutchinson, and it's incredibly bizarre. It's very weird. It's extremely funny. It's sort of the most HQ thing I've seen in a long time.
It's so deeply offensive too. It minimizes her and marginal. It's just great.
Yeah, it's perfect. He nailed it.
But anyway, as I was saying, it's like here's this woman. This first of all, we laugh about it, but this January, and you talk about the dissolution of a country into devolving into worse than banana republic status. We have this January 6th commission, which seeks to crucify anybody who was at the Capitol protesting what was a stolen election and turned into a so-called riot when the riot and all the violence itself was fomented by the very same people who are sitting in judgment of the people that they're accusing of insurrection, who actually caused the insurrection themselves. So this woman claims that she heard it from a friend, if I can quote REO Speedwagon, that supposedly Donald Trump lunged across the dashboard of the presidential limo, the Beast, which is like about as long as a tractor trailer, and tried to grab the steering wheel from a Secret Service agent. It's just ridiculous.
And I find the whole thing just so, like, darkly comical, is that have these people never been in a car? Right. I mean, if you've ever been in a car, in the back seat of a car, especially in a big car, which most people have, even if it's just in a taxi, if you're not in that, I'm chauffeured around in a limo class, big cars are big. The steering wheel is far away from you. There are all these obstacles, like seats and the driver in the way if you happen to be in the rear of the car. And the idea that Donald Trump, who is a very big. I mean, he's physically a big guy. He's a little bit portly. And he's a septuagenarian. Yeah, this big, chubby 70-year-old was leaping like Jason Bourne into the front seat to grab the wheel. And then you have to stop and consider, again, this isn't just a big car. This is an armored presidential vehicle, whether it's the official limo or one of the SUVs, and apparently it was an SUV, but they're still up-armored. Right. I mean, the idea that this guy is surging across the threshold into the front seat and grappling with the driver and snatching the wheel. No, he wasn't.
Of course he wasn't. And the thing is that,
come on, these people have never been in a car. Like, how do you even come up with this lie? It's so preposterous that you would think that the people crafting this bombshell testimony, and it clearly was crafted, it was synthetic from the start, you would think that somebody somewhere would go, hey, guys, that's not how cars work.
This will have entered the lexicon at HuffPo and, you know, a few of the more maniacal leftist sites. And the vast majority of Americans don't give a shit. They don't care about Madison Cornbread. I love that name. They don't care about the January 6th hearings. They don't care about Liz Cheney. They don't care about anything except for gas prices, food prices, and the fact that one of them's going to get laid off in the next 6 months because we're in a goddamn recession. And for the Democrat Party to push this kind of stuff that is just unbelievably unimportant to America is fan fucking tastic. You know, as I've said before, let them just step back, let them fuck up.
I thought this Christine Balsey Ford, the Kavanaugh Inquisition, if you will, I thought she was horrendous. But this thing just in its own way even outdoes that in its most just ludicrous, ridiculous, at least you know, she's making an accusation of something that happened 30 years ago, which either is. You know, could be corroborated or not corroborated. Even the rape train crap was kind of out there. But this thing, Donald Trump leaping gazelle-like across a freaking thing, is just idiotic. And actually, you know, in a way, Joe, you actually, I thought you were sort of channeling Kamala Harris when you said, big cars are big.
I just chuckle. Thanks for that.
It wasn't you. I love it. It's great. But this thing is such a freaking insult. We're laughing at it. But as I say, you know, we laugh the laughter of the damned, you know.
Yeah, it reeks of desperation to me. They needed something. Right. And I think what it comes down to in a way is these are the January 6th show trials have been a flop. Right. They've outright used the language that they're producing this. Right. It's a big production. It's for the purpose of being on TV. and nobody's watching them. They get fewer viewers than the nightly newscasts, even when they run it in primetime. And
the
rerun of Young Sheldon
was number one on the first night. I have to bring that in. I'm sorry, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. And I'm wondering if they're like, we need something big. We need something really, really powerful and shocking in order to get those butts in the seats and those eyeballs on the screen. And this is what they came up with.
But, you know, what I was trying to say was that it seems antithetical to everything that Trump believes. He is not, you know, yeah, sure, he goes out and plays golf and whacks the ball around, has a good time. But he's very respectful of the process, and I think too respectful of the process. And for him to behave in this way just doesn't seem like him. So not only do they make up this ridiculous story out of whole cloth, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't sound like the Donald Trump that we have come to know over the past 6 years, 7 years.
Yeah, it is totally ridiculous. But of course, yeah, you know, CBD, as you alluded to, it's the meme machine, so to speak, to sort of pay tribute to the longest yard meme machine. But the meme machine, you know, generates what it generates. And as they say, you know, a lie is around the world twice before the truth puts its pants on and gets out of bed. So alluding to what you said also about, you know, $6 a gallon gasoline, supply chain shortages, no baby formula, your money being devalued almost on an hourly basis now, and we're heading towards stagflation, recession, and possibly, you know, a depression and a total crash of our economic system. Nobody gives a flying fig about this here, you know, these hearings, which are just a total farce. People have moved beyond that. And they see, you know, it's funny, more and more people actually to that point are starting to believe that if they don't believe the election was stolen, which I know and you know and Joe and everybody knows that this thing was stolen, at the very least, they are now starting to believe that there was some very hinky crap going on election night and afterwards. So this whole thing is just caving in, and there's no stopping it. Now, will there be another pandemic right before the midterms? I think they're kind of hinting at that, but so far there is nothing that's going to stop them from getting wiped out this November, and quite probably in November of 2024. So, I mean, whether it's by Trump or whether it's by DeSantis or whether it's by whomever, they are trying desperately to gin up some sort of a charge. Or go to the DOJ to charge him with an insurrection violation to prevent him from running, and not just him, other candidates that might have been on the Capitol that day, and that's their Hail Mary right now. I don't see any other reason for this other than just to put it out there.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about Trump and the possibility that he's going to run. And he pointed out something that I thought was very interesting, and that is that the left is going balls to the wall to destroy Donald Trump. And even assuming that they are successful, that he becomes so toxic that he decides not to run or he doesn't get the nomination, that might not be such a good thing for the Democrat Party and for the socialists and the progressives in America. Because who are they going to get if they destroy Donald Trump? Well, we have a fairly nice looking bench out there. Of course, my first choice is Ron DeSantis, but there are a few other people in the United States who would be fine presidents. So I would say to the Democrats, be careful what you wish for. Anyway, that's just a thought.
Absolutely. And a point that I've made repeatedly over the years is that despite all the nonsense spewed about him, Donald Trump is not a revolutionary. Donald Trump is a reformer. And if this is what they do to a reformer, and if they make reform impossible, then a revolutionary will eventually be what they get.
It's a perfect point, because if you look at Donald Trump's behavior as when he was president, he was extraordinarily deferential to very, very questionable legal decisions. He did not push back against the judiciary, and that's not a revolutionary. That, as Joe points out, that's a reformer. He accepted the status quo, and he tried to work within the system.
Yeah, I think that was his Achilles heel and his downfall, as we all know, is that he believed that going into Washington D.C. that there were people of honesty and integrity that would just, you know, abide by the same rules and norms and traditions that, look, hey, you lost, too bad, tough luck, try better next time, or better luck next time. And no, they were out to sabotage him and destroy him at every level. His worst enemies weren't the Democrats. His worst enemies were the people allegedly in his own party who sabotaged him at every freaking turn. You know, you have to, if he, let's say he does run and he does win, if that happens, I would hope, I would imagine that, you know, once burned is he's learned his lesson, and he is never going to trust anybody that is recommended to him that comes from Washington, D.C. I hate to say it, even people that were sort of supposedly outsiders, like whoever it was, some of his advisors, maybe, I don't think Mnuchin was a D.C. insider. I don't think that who's the old guy that was also one of his economic advisors? All of these people were not from D.C. They weren't from the swamp. And yet they also kind of turned on him and I wouldn't say if they didn't sabotage him outright, they certainly sort of slow walked the agenda as best they could. But the whole thing was revelatory for me at the outset with Obamacare. When John McCain frickin' turned his thumb down at the whole thing, I said, and when Paul Ryan sabotaged everything else, I said, this is ridiculous. And so, and that's just from the congressional, from the political party. Forget about just the bureaucracy. So I think whoever runs in there, it has to be a revolution to the extent you cannot hire anybody from within D.C. You have to do everything you can to absolutely try to neuter or otherwise do away with the bureaucracy to get your agenda going. And again, this is the pickle we're in. We have this bureaucracy that will sabotage you nine ways till Sunday, as Chuck Schumer said. And so we're in this netherworld of in between business as usual and in between some sort of a transition to whatever other form of government we will have. Hopefully it's one that we can bend to our will, but of course the left is going to do everything it can to go the other way. I've floored you with my geniusness.
You have.
On that genius note, let's take a little bit of a break. Cut Jib Newsletter speaks. We'll be back in a flash. Hang on. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. JJ Sefton here with CBD and the great Joe Mannix. We have time for one more good segment, but we're going to do the quick hits. So CBD, what you got on the quick hits page there?
So I just harvested some of the tabs that I have open, and the first one that jumped out at me, and I think that Sefton covered it in one of the morning reports, but a trans woman defeated a 29-year-old trans woman defeated a 13-year-old girl in the New York City skateboarding championship. She must be so proud. It must be so wonderful he's a fucking guy. So a 29-year-old man beat up on a 13-year-old girl and actually was proud of himself. It just amazes me that the left is going balls to the wall. Oh, literally balls to the wall.
balls in between your legs.
Yeah. In supporting these fucking lunatics, I apologize for the profanity, but it's appropriate. These fucking lunatics who are beating up on little girls. And this is the future of America? They're nuts.
Better than the typical one of these stories, like with Thomas, the swimmer, right? This is not only a man competing against a woman. This is a grown man competing against an adolescent girl. Like, it's as absurd as I could come up with. It's astounding.
You know, in a way, it would have been. It may not have been that great if the little girl had beaten the freakazoid there, because then it would have legitimized the competition. You see, it's a fair play. She beat him, so maybe it's better that she took a beating. But what a horrendous thing! What a just absolutely, we have gone nuts. I mean, we talked about Red China. You know, I mean, it's a race to the bottom, folks. I mean, which society will absolutely lose this thing? The Red Chinese, which are depopulating themselves and are just totally corrupt, or America, which has decided to absolutely go insane over transsexualism, homosexuality, and every other ism you can imagine, and do away with meritocracy and all that. So crazy, just absolutely, we're insane. It's official.
So the next hit, which I got a big chuckle out of this, there was a National Review article last week. The writer spoke about an article in TRT World, which is a Turkish Islamist outlet. And the pull quote was, "There would be no Shakespeare were it not for Islam," which I love, because this is the third world pushback against Western philosophy, Western society. Let's face it. Western society is responsible for 99% of the success of the human race. It began 500 years before Christ, and it accelerated up through probably the 1980s, 1990s. The West, unfortunately, is imploding and is suicidal and is doing its best to destroy what took 2,500 years to create. But the idea that the third world is trying to get their little taste of this success amuses the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it sort of reminds me of a meme from the old Star Trek, where every time there was a great invention, it was like, you know, Chekhov would claim Great Russian invented it, you know, whether it was, you know, but here we have, yes, an Islamist. William Shakespeare was inspired by Islam. I don't know how that is a possibility, but again, it's if they can't kill you with a rusty hacksaw, if they can't hijack an airliner and fly it into the World Trade Center, what will they do? They'll just usurp your history. Well, I mean, where have we heard that before? Well, that's what the left does all the time. They claim, yeah, I think the big claim was that Christ was gay. So I don't know which is crazier, that William Shakespeare was inspired by Islam or that Jesus was a homosexual. So it's a toss up, friends.
It's and it's the sort of coattails thing that is, I've seen it put like tongue in cheek in another context, which is whenever there's a great Scottish accomplishment, whether it's an engineer or whatever, mostly engineering, they're brilliant engineers, but that those are always great British inventors. But the moment that there's a Scottish serial killer, that's a Scottish serial killer.
You bring up Scotland, and you know, it's Scotland has become the butt of many, many jokes in the last dozen years or so. But Joe pointed out something very interesting. Scotland is a very small country, and they have had an unbelievable, outsized effect on the success of humanity over the last 250 years.
Well, it's the Scottish Enlightenment. So there you go.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Anyway, the next hit also gave me a chuckle. So Ben & Jerry's, everybody's most hated ice cream company, began to push back against one of their distributors, one of their manufacturers in Israel. And they essentially cut this Israeli manufacturer and distributor off from the Ben & Jerry's brand. Unfortunately for Ben & Jerry's, they are owned by Unilever. And Unilever got enough pushback that they simply sold out from under Ben & Jerry's, the distributor in Israel, sold it to the Israeli, and now he can do whatever he wants with the Ben & Jerry's name. And this is just a wonderful example of, you know, get woke, go broke. Ben & Jerry's, they have their politics, good for them. Unilever has responsibilities to their stockholders. And they thought that was more important. So Ben & Jerry's got a nice, fat slapdown. And it just warms the cockles of my heart.
Well, you know, I've got to say that given the history of Ben & Jerry's, of these two chuckleheads, I mean, they are anti-Israeli. They are totally down for the whole Palestinian myth of, you know, of the stolen land and all that kind of garbage. And I don't understand why Israel would even want a Ben & Jerry's in the first place. But I guess since the Israel Philharmonic does now, thanks to Zubin Mehta, perform Wagner, I guess they can have a Ben & Jerry's and eat it too in this regard. So, you know, my fellow co-religionists in the land of Israel, enjoy your big scoop full of Rachel Corrie Crunch. So,
you know, Israel's an interesting place, and Israelis are interesting people. They are very, very happy to be in the universe of nations on this planet. They don't want to boycott. They don't want to worry about what their passport says. They want to visit the world. They want to enjoy the world. And the idea that Ben and Jerry's didn't want them was silly to them. So now that they can eat Ben and Jerry's again, good for them.
I guess Joe doesn't give a shit about Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah, obviously.
No, it's, I just can't think of anything to add.
Okay, well, there you go. Any other quick hits, my friends?
Oh, yeah, my favorite stoner magazine, Reason Magazine, their writing is chaotic. It's absolutely insane. And their newest bit of insanity is an article written about a week ago by Damon Root, who is obviously more stoned than anyone at that magazine. And the headline is, Alito's abortion ruling overturning Roe is an insult to the Ninth Amendment. And it is a hysterical, catastrophic misreading of the Constitution and the amendments. And he goes on for paragraph after paragraph, blathering incredible crap. And it really is sad because, you know, about 1% of their articles are worthwhile. I think that their pushback against the militarization of the police in the United States is extremely important, and I read them all the time. And their pushback against, that's about it. That's their only topic about which they have any sense of balance. Everything else is nuts. And the idea that a libertarian thinks that unrestricted murder of pre-born children is a good thing makes no sense to me. But it's this reflexive hatred of the right, whether it's the traditional right or the new right or the Trump right, it doesn't matter to them. If it's on the right, they're against it.
When you sent this article to us, CBD, to review, like, it's astonishing. Right. I'd like to read just one little excerpt from it, if I may. Quote, today, most legal conservatives purport to be constitutional originalists. What that means for the legal debate over abortion is that any purported originalist must face the question of whether abortion rights may be considered to be among the unenumerated rights retained by the people that Madison's Ninth Amendment was specifically written and ratified to protect, end quote. This is fascinating in its madness, because first of all, Roe didn't find that there was a right to abortion. It found that there was a right to privacy, for one thing, and just abortion sort of fell under that umbrella, which is duplicative, I think, against the Fourth Amendment. But that's neither here nor there, and I'm also not a constitutional scholar. But the entire argument presupposes that abortion is a right. That's settled. That's all fixed. And that right is under the Ninth Amendment, and therefore overturning it federally is wrong, while also fully ignoring the 10th Amendment. This whole article is just fascinating.
Isn't it?
And people should read it. It's pretty out there. It's I don't understand how you get from A to B, and the article doesn't do a very good job of guiding me there.
I got to tell you, it's I find it very funny, and I don't mean funny, ha ha, that the left has spent the last, you know, possibly, as you say, CBT, since Lincoln, or before, trying to absolutely destroy the United States Constitution when it can, and yet at the same time, it will hide behind the U.S. Constitution when it's to their advantage. So they use it both as a shield and a cudgel to take that thing away and flush it down on the toilet. And it's just absolutely disgusting. As you say, Joe, there is no right to abortion in the Constitution anywhere. There is no right to privacy. Look, I mean, I defy anybody to look at the Constitution and find those words. Of course, we have penumbras and enumerations, and it was written in invisible ink that William Brennan can decipher, because he can channel the founders and the framers back in SCOTUS chambers when he was deciding the case. But it's ridiculous that these things don't exist. They hate the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment with a passion, yet now they hide behind it. It's the same thing. They declare nullification, like sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, we have states' rights. When you said states' rights, that was sort of a dog whistle for racism. These people, the hypocrisy is just freaking radiant and absolutely disgusting, and it makes my blood boil.
Well, with that, Yeah, you know, Joe, that paragraph that you read is just marvelous. You could probably swap out abortion rights to slavery rights, and it would make as much sense, which means it would make no sense at all. But, you know, the larger question of the move, the entire, I'm not even sure I can call it a movement anymore. Reason doesn't represent most people in America. I think they represent a tiny little fringe who believe that libertarianism is still a viable option in this day and age. But, you know, for entertainment's sake, we need to keep them around.
Yeah, and that was always true. They've never represented most people, but they at least wanted to. As near as I could tell, they don't even want to anymore. And fine, that's on them. It's their publication. Do what you want.
Yeah. On that cheerful note, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure, always. J.J. Sefton here, along with CBD and Joe Mannix for the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. Keep the cards and letters coming. Hit the tip jar, and we will see you again on the next one. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks, everyone, and have a great Independence Day.